The 11 a.m. meeting found Morgan and Metzger present. Cases were presented. Metzger explained the performance, what the committee was all about. He first told them what the faculty committee charge meant, then explained to them that they were, in effect, a grand jury. They were hearing allegations, and if the allegations were sufficiently serious, they should then refer these cases to the committees A, B, or perhaps some alternative such as counseling. Then the first case was presented. And this was a case where a guy threatened a couple of people, used hard language, put his knee in the back of someone, and so on. And the vote was 2-2-1 to send this to Subcommittee A. Two in favor, two against, and one abstaining, this being Professor Olson, Professor Newman, who apparently was for dismissing them all, or at least not referring them until some later time. However, he was persuaded that that was not a good thing to do, and the other student, one of the two students, also was persuaded that maybe they should be sent to A, and so the next vote was 4-1, and the tie was broken, and the first four cases were sent 4-1, 4-1, 4-1, and 3-2 to the Subcommittee A. This session then ended at about 2 p.m. There had been much discussion, apparently, by Steve Sloan over whether or not what they were doing made any sense. And either at this session or at other sessions, he made the point that they could be referred to Subcommittee B, and then B could refer them back to A if more damning evidence than that being presented was found. In most cases, apparently, the charge simply said that Mr. So-and-so was present, was arrested on the charge of mob action at a certain time in the morning, and that he was a student at the university, and that he was of a certain age and in a certain class. Apparently, little else has said these charges, and they're all very much the same, except for very few. At 7:30, there was another session. This session, the 11 o'clock session, ended at about 2, and at 7:30 in the evening, there was another session. Here, Millett appeared and gave a half-hour speech on their duty to send everyone to A. Apparently, Millett was argued with and then left, and Skoufis took up this argument, and giving other reasons why they should go to A. However, the committee then voted to rescind the morning's action, so they would like to reconsider what they had done so far. Skoufis again argued that the appeal protection clause made it necessary to send them to A, that they couldn't send them to B. Something about A can't, if a thing is appealed to A, they can't give out a stiffer sentence than that given out by B. Why that should affect anything is beyond my comprehension, but apparently Scoop has made some argument of this sort. Now, the vote was then 2-3 on sending them all to Subcommittee B. In other words, that lost. Two students apparently voting for it, three faculty members voting against it. Then there was a motion that only those who had specific extra charges filed against them should go to A, and that all the others should go to B, who were simply present. But this motion was withdrawn almost as soon as it was offered, because the afternoon had seen a meeting between the two student representatives to this committee, and Hackman and Cooper and people of that sort in Senate office, and they had argued that all the students should be treated the same way, that whatever was done with them, it should be done equally, that there should be no separating out of people at this point. So there was then a revote on sending, and they agreed to send, by the 3-2 vote, all students to A, but Newman apparently held out. Case, the charge written out and the name before he would sign the referral. Apparently, in other words, he is not willing to give blanket permission to Morgan and Company simply to routinely send everybody to a particular committee. Therefore, now there was some more discussion apparently, and eight more cases were sent to A. This was at that evening session on Tuesday. On Friday, this is now then Tuesday the 16th, something like that. On Friday the 20th, at 2 p.m., the committee met again, and 13 more cases were sent to A by a 4-1 vote. However, there was still one dissident student member who argued that he did not like what was going on at all and really couldn't be a part to it, and he was apparently told that if he didn't like it, he could leave, that they would understand, that his conscience wouldn't allow him to do it, but they hoped that he wouldn't continue to argue and hold up what was a perfectly legal process. So, the next meeting is this coming Friday at 2 p.m., and by that time, Newman hopes that and has asked them to see if they could have all the cases filled out, and he would hope to process all the remaining ones at that time. Now, one of the student members on the committee feels that they should have been sent to B because, one, Subcommittee A has a bad reputation, and the students may be afraid of having Subcommittee A hang over their heads, and B has real students on it. There's a hassle over the appointment of the three students to Subcommittee A. Apparently the three students on that committee are ones left over from last year who elected to remain in the committee, asked to remain. Cornyn would very much like to appoint new people to this committee and is unhappy about his inability to do that. So there's some discussion of the legitimacy of Committee A, and certainly the students, and this particular student, did not feel Subcommittee A would be a hospitable place to send these kids. And three makes the point that none of these referral committee sessions was it ever established that there had been a mass demonstration. Apparently mass demonstration is the charge that the university is lobbying against these people. That was simply assumed, that no evidence of that was ever presented. That they were told that the evidence was not important, that all they were to do was to decide how they were to refer it on the basis of the allegations. There was also not discussed whether mass demonstration is a serious matter and whether that should go to A. Apparently it was argued that it should by Metzger, Millett, and Skoufis, but this particular student was not convinced. Apparently one of Newman's reasons for wanting all the people referred, for not wanting to sign a blanket referral, is that he wants everyone referred before any actually go into a hearing by a subcommittee. He wants the whole referral process to be completed before anything else begins. Okay, I guess that ends the report to this meeting on Wednesday and Friday night of what had been going on all week in the Subcommittee A. This knowledgeable source was called in to tell us what had been going on so we could find out just what the score was. Morrison was scheduled to meet with Addison and Berkey, apparently, at 9, and he did leave to go to that meeting at 9. But the whole point of this dinner session, which included Dean West, was to simply discuss the background, the apparent sellout by Millett and Metzger, and what should be done about it, what kind of a line Morrison should take with Berkey. It turned out that Berkey didn't show up at that meeting. That was just Morrison and Addison, and apparently they chatted about the general situation with rather little conclusion. There is some evidence, incidentally, from what's been going on the referral committee, that the charge that Morrison and company are leveling, which is that the tactic being taken by Millett, Morgan, and Metzger is to kick out students who are, quote, leaders, but who are not necessarily involved in the damage, seems to be some evidence for that, because at least one charge read, refusal to obey a reasonable request, and another one read, telling people not to leave. And telling people not to leave the union apparently is not a good thing, and this is a charge being made against a student. This would look as if, in fact, the fears of Morrison and company are somewhat founded, and something perhaps should be done about that. Mel Reif points out that Millett apparently fought in the Senate committee for a distinction between those who, quote, willfully refused to leave the union before arrests and after warnings of arrest, and other students who were not in that position. And this sounds enough like the terminology in the federal loan funding, NDEA stuff, that's been in the news this week, that he thinks Millett is really trying to get these kids convicted of something that would withdraw their financial support. It is interesting that Millett is pushing that particular line. While we were in the union, Belden Fields dropped by, listened in on a little bit of this, and said that Paul Wells of Economics and Herb Semmel of Law are making an independent investigation of what went on, what is going on. Okay. I think that brings me up to date in that particular notebook. This is a random detail which nowhere else seems to have gotten into the record. That is that Tuesday morning at 4 or 5 a.m., whenever it was, when Bruce was reading his phone conversations with Millett and Peldison into the record for our publication, he did try to do so as an anonymous student, and there was immediate pressure put on him by Berkey and Fine to identify himself in print. And he hesitated a little while and then said, okay, what the hell, Bruce Morrison of the Graduate Student Association. That's just a little interesting little vignette. I also don't know if I have in here the fact that it was basically Rossman who got me out of the bag of fighting for the Chancellor's, the all of Chancellor's statement, which I had to try to reconstruct from what Bruce had told me right after the Chancellor had spoken to him. Bruce wanted to have him quoted as saying only that he hoped to prevent another Columbia, and that was why he had had the arrests. I, of course, fought for the line about his concern for the 500 program, and it was finally put in a form that was not terribly complimentary to him. It simply showed that it was in his mind, and that the decision he made was calculated, fully knowing that he might be damaging the 500 program, but that certainly was at least one of his considerations. You know, Rossman basically came to my defense because of my agony, not because of any ideological agreement with me, and convinced the others that this was not so damaging to their case, that Peldison was really a rat, and that I should be indulged. These details of the meeting I don't believe I've read in before. It's Tuesday, the 24th of September, and about 3 p.m. I think the most functional way to proceed here is to recount a luncheon conversation with Jillian and Bill first, and then go back to things that happened a little bit further in the past. Okay, just finished that lunch. A couple of interesting things came out of it. One of them is that Jillian says that there was a rumor, at least, operating at about 2:30, that some of the kids who had done the damage and had left the Union were returning into the Union with arms, with firearms, and that apparently a graduate assistant in the dorms overheard a plainclothesman on the phone talking and got the story that way. So there was a reason for the university to send in those police, another reason that we didn't know about maybe earlier. Next, the story that she gets is that the kids who did the smashing and so on were high school kids from Champaign-Urbana who did not make it into the program and who had a grudge and were pushing it off that way. She went on to tell a very interesting story about Stevie Jackson and a friend of hers. She said she's had several run-ins with him. One of them was finding him up on the girls' floor, apparently with bourbon. And, of course, guys aren't supposed to be in the dorms at all. And they also is not supposed to be booze in the dorms, so that's about as many violations as you can wrap up in one incident. And she kicked him out, and he went. She also says that there was a rather interesting incident, and I will describe it as much as possible the way she did. Apparently, Jackson and a friend got into a white girl went to talk to some of the black girls on her floor and find out why they were having such complaints about the university housing, and apparently she attempted to defend the university in this whole thing. The girls just simply interpreted it as a white racist honky argument, and apparently really lit into her. And Jackson and someone else got involved in this whole thing, and they had really raked the girl over the coals. Well, she and Jill were sitting out in front of ISR that same evening, and Jackson and his friend came up. And apparently, Jill had reported Jackson and his friend for having harassed this girl, or perhaps for having been up on the floor. Anyway, she had turned them in. So the guys came over, and they said to the little girl, "Why did you turn us in?" And Jill said, "They didn't turn you in." And they said, "Well, you couldn't have done it, because they said that a white girl turned us in." And Jill said, "Well, what the hell do you think I am?" And they said, "Well, you're not white, you're Italian." And then he says, "In fact, maybe you're not Italian, maybe you're a Jew." At this point, apparently, the black kid had his nose about an inch from Jill's nose. Well, she stood her ground and, said, "So what," apparently. Anyway, it got off that and over onto this girl, and they went back to the argument again, and she was called a white racist honky, and she tried to protest that all she was trying to do was understand why the thing had happened. She was trying to understand black people. She was told that she couldn't understand black people because she was white, and it was really hopeless that she shouldn't try. She was just messing around. And then she protested that wasn't true, that they were all human beings, some argument of that sort. And apparently, then they said, "Prove it. Prove that you can think of us as human beings." And you can imagine what the proof was, I guessed, before Jill told me. Apparently, one of the black guys said, I dare you to give me a kiss." Well, she took up the dare, and she thought she was going to give him a nice little peck. But apparently, he grabbed her, and she really gave him a good French kiss. And he gave her a really good French kiss. The point was, this apparently really humiliated her thoroughly, and so she burst into tears and ran into the dorm. But Jill says it's amazing that what happened to Stevie Jackson at this point, apparently, he really was touched. And it finally, she said it was obvious that it had gotten across to him that she too was a human being, this little girl. And he immediately said to Jill, you know, he says, I'm really sorry about that. What's her number? What's her room number? He says, I got to call her and try to explain that to her. You know, and Jill said, well, frankly, maybe the best thing happened in a way. Maybe you just both learned something and you should leave it alone. But he really, really apparently felt very bad and he wanted to do something. And so I guess he did call her, and I really don't know where it came out. Jill said she hadn't found up any more details, but she said it was quite apparent that his rhetoric, that a lot of the things he says are true, that his rhetoric carries him away, that he really convinces himself that white people are devils and that you can't talk to them. But it's quite apparent that he is very capable of coming around, that at least in this instance it was apparent to her that that's what had happened. Okay, end of story. The next thing that Jill pointed out was, well, I guess that's about it for Jill. Okay. Now I will go to a meeting yesterday between, this is Monday now, Monday the 23rd. I had a meeting for an hour from 2 to 3 with Dean Millett. And I will try to get this into the record now.